if the Royal Commission continues to kick the can down the road, I'm convinced their ultimate plan is just to turn the vast majority of the state into a toxic Superfund site. And unfortunately, the earthquakes will get to a certain point where the water will break through all the way to surface. And then we'll end up with a Great Salt Lake of basically toxic radioactive isotope water. And we started to see the first symptoms of that on December 7th this last year, when that first well broke through from 600 feet all the way to surface on its own. We still don't know how it flowed all of a sudden from 600 feet to surface. The Royal Commission supposedly plugged it, although nobody actually was there to witness and verify what they did and how they did it. But we know they spent $2.5 million of taxpayer money to get it sorted. This area around Crane County, Pecos County, Ward County is really truly ground zero for the imminent disaster that is building. This is a race you need to have done your homework on. This is number 4 on the ballot. It's the only executive position in 2024. This one really is going to make the difference in the state of Texas.
Hello, 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 and welcome back to the El Paso Beat. Yes, I'm back. Not that I really went anywhere. Just wasn't really doing anything for the podcast, and it's not because I didn't want to. It's not because I didn't miss you guys like crazy, because I did. It's just been really, really, really tough, busy. I think the last time we spoke was for Marianne Williamson's episode, which was quite a while ago now. Marianne has in fact dropped out of the race since. And I actually had another interview recorded with House District 77 candidate Alexandra Anello. There were portions of the interview, and I will preface that with I did a terrible job of preparing for that interview. I should have done so much more preparation. It was my first interview in a minute, and I had gotten rusty because it wasn't like I was an exceptional journalist or anything even before that. But it wasn't the best job I could have done, and then I was just sworn because it was like at the tail end of December. It was before the runoff. Not the runoff. Was it before the runoff? It was before the runoff. It was before the runoff for the District 2 special election. And we talked about that a little bit because she's the former District 2 city representative. She's now been succeeded by Josh Acevedo, Dr. Josh Acevedo. And, you know, we talked about the race, we talked about her decision to run and things like that. But a lot of it felt time sensitive, and I didn't get the work that I was hoping to get that I thought would give me more free time, ironically. And so I have been working my same work situation, which doesn't leave a ton of free time on the weekends for me right now, especially doesn't during the holiday season. That's kind of a good time for DoorDash on the weekends. And so I was doing everything I could to stay on top of things, and the podcast fell by the wayside. And then by the time I realized it was like mid-January, half of that interview was no longer relevant. And I felt like it was more of a disservice to post it and it just didn't feel right to share it at that point. And then at that point, by mid-January, I'm at a point where like the primary is in full swing. And like, if I kind of had felt like, okay, well, if I start covering races, if I start with this race with Alex, with, you know, Repinello, I have to keep going. I have to cover more races, right? I can't just cover this one. And I had already covered a couple of the DA's candidates. I still had another DA candidate to interview, and I never got around to. And the sheriff's race is a really contentious race right now. I didn't get a chance to sit down and that's not entirely true either. You know, something had kind of worked itself out where I did interview many of the candidates in a way that I wouldn't be able to really share with you all, because the El Paso Young Democrats had their endorsement committee established. Well, I established an endorsement committee for the El Paso Young Democrats as their president, and the committee was tasked with vetting candidates for endorsement. And so the way we did it is we had interviews with candidates that we wanted to have interviews with for the races that we wanted to endorse in. And I wrote questions. I asked all the candidates you know, the same questions for their races. Each candidate had, you know, every candidate had a few of the same questions. Something that we have our candidates, and maybe I shouldn't be saying this, because it's probably something that we'll do in the future. And I really enjoy hearing people's answer, and I don't want candidates to come prepared. No, not really. But it's really fun when you get into like the really nonpartisan partisan races, like the DA's race or the sheriff's race, where yeah, like they're partisan races. It's, you know, these folks are running as Democrats. But like when you really get down to the brass tacks, like we're not asking them to write laws. You know, they're in law enforcement in a sense. And so, I mean, I understand why the partisan aspect makes you feel like it's important that there needs to be that partisan kind of identity to the candidate. But in these races, like, you know, it's not as, where am I going with this? The partisan aspect is not as baked into the nature of the job for these races. And so when we were interviewing candidates for DA and sheriff and every position, actually, we ask them, what does it mean to you to be a Democrat? And I got very different answers from pretty much every candidate, which is great. It's awesome. You know, because, well, I don't know about, I guess it's cool to have those perspectives and hear so many different reasons of why a single political party could reach and influence and resonate with so many different people on so many different levels and what that means to them individually. But it is also a great way to see how their party identity will affect how they do these jobs, because that's at the end of the day what it means when they're running as a Democrat. And so all of the candidates answer a question like that. You know, we do get into the like, well, you know, what are your qualifications and why do you want this position? Blah, 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 blah. You know, the real basic stuff. But each race also had questions specifically written for that race. And I don't like to, you know, toot my own horn too much on my show, you know, but I thought the questions were insightful. I wrote them in a way to kind of evoke answers that would differentiate the candidates from each other. And there is no intention to have these interviews shared with the public. These interviews, I have set it up so that these interviews are accessible to my members, because I feel like it is there. It belongs to them. You know, even if they didn't agree with the way the endorsement committee goes through the, you know, how they voted, you can listen to the interview for yourself and you can be like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to listen to the candidates for myself. And maybe you end up on the same side as the endorsement committee. Maybe you don't, but like, you know, these interviews are specifically for the Young Dems. And so I won't be publishing them in the way that I have published like a Young Dem meeting in the past with State Rep Morales or, you know, whatever. But it did get me thinking and realizing like, hey, like, it's not that difficult for you to have like a bunch of these questions pre-written, pre-thought out. And endorsement interviews, you know, aside from one candidate who like flew through his interview, in like 15 minutes, I was impressed. But, you know, most of the candidates, when I told them, hey, you can take all the time you want, like unpack your answers, they did. And each conversation, each, you know, interview ended up being close to an hour. And it's like, well, if I was releasing these interviews, this content, I could see people listening to it and being like, oh, wow, like this is good stuff. It's finally some good content out of this show, you know? And so a part of me is a little disappointed that I can't show, that I won't be showing, you know, sharing those interviews. But in a sense, too, it also reaffirms to me, it's like, I can do this. I know how to do this. I just need to like sit down and put the energy into doing it, because admittedly, you know, there's a level of pressure with being the president of the Young Dems not to screw it up too badly. And so I wanted to make sure that these were good, thoughtful questions. And so for each race, I was like sitting there and like racking my brain. Is like, okay, you only get a handful of questions to ask and you have to like differentiate them. And you know, it's just, I think that whole, and this whole experience with the endorsement committee has made me a stronger interviewer. Maybe you're going to hear that in today's conversation with Bill Birch, because this conversation just happened this past weekend. This very fast turnaround for an episode, I know. And I felt like, you know, I sat through that conversation much more prepared. Well, even slightly more prepared than I feel like I've gone into conversations, interviews in the past for this show, but maybe not even like as prepared. Like, I only had like a couple of main topics that I really wanted him to cover, and he did cover them. And so I didn't have a lot of questions. And so it could have very easily turned into, oh, we're done in 10 minutes and I don't have questions and now there's nothing else to talk about. But he, you know, he took a good amount of time. We actually spent an hour talking, and there's still more I feel like we could have explored and talked about, which is great. I would actually love to have him back on in the future and, you know, expand on this more, because he's been, you know, he's, as you will hear, he's had quite the career, has had quite a number of pretty unique experiences, and has some really cool perspective. And I'm excited for what Bill potentially can do for the Railroad Commission, for the state. I'm really excited for you guys to hear that conversation. And I think I have maybe a couple of other things, but I think we should just stop right there and go on to that conversation. Let's do that. I do have a couple more things to talk about, but I think for now, I'm going to let you enjoy this conversation with the EPYD endorsed candidate for the Railroad Commission, Bill Birch. And I'll see you on the other side. Okay, folks, it has been a minute. I know, you know, you heard in the intro, we had talked about it a little bit, but I am here with our first guest in a good minute, the first guest of the year, I guess now, since we're listening to this. And it's the candidate for nominee for Railroad Commissioner. Now, you know that I can't start a conversation without talking about how this conversation ties to the conversations that I've been having with the Texas Young Democrats and my favorite little chat group. And I was looking back for it because I remember this conversation back in October. It just came up one morning. One of the members of the group, who's, you know, much more experienced, been worked with the ledge and everything, just drops into the chat. So, who's running for Railroad Commissioner? And there were some jokes thrown around, and, you know, yada yada yada. And I decided to chime in. You guys know I don't really chime in these conversations. I like to stay as a fly on the wall. But I chimed in with one of those with a funny gif of "I'll do it, but just for the attention." And people were, you know, people laughed, people reacted, but at that moment it was like, yeah, okay, fine. You know, we need someone to run. And in that moment I was kind of like, crap. That means like, and that's not good. Like if we're even able to joke about, sure, yeah, let Richard run for Railroad Commissioner, we must be in a pretty, pretty tough spot. But luckily that is not the case we find ourselves in. We actually have a very, very strong and knowledgeable candidate for Railroad Commissioner, our guest today, Bill Birch. I am so excited to bring him to you guys. I've had the chance to listen to him a few times when he's visited El Paso during his campaign. And he's going to talk to you about the earthquake that we experienced. I guess now it's been a couple of months, but you know, I know many of you have that fresh in your memory. And it's not going to get any better. This is going to keep happening. And that's not something that El Paso is built for. It's not something that we keep in mind. And so we need to start putting it to front of mind. And not only is it going, you know, can Bill explain why it's happening, but he's going to explain why it's going to get worse if we don't get ahead of this, and how he plans to do that. So I'm going to stop talking. I'm very excited to have Bill Birch today. So Bill, welcome to the El Paso Beat.
Thank you, Richard, and thank you for having me on. I appreciate the opportunity.
That's my pleasure. And now we need to talk about earthquakes and the oil and gas industry and everything that they're doing. But first, let's take a few minutes. I'd love to hear a little bit more about you. Give listeners a chance to get to know you a bit.
Well, thank you. I live in East Texas. I live in Polk County, about 95 miles north of Houston, which is a little city called Livingston, Texas. We are a very small, rural, deep piney woods Texas community. I am a third generation driller. My grandfather and my father were both drillers. And interestingly, my path kind of led that way as well. I mean, I remember as a kid helping my dad work on the rig and getting yelled at the whole time about, you drop this, don't do that, don't touch this. So why I ever agreed to ever go in this business is a whole nother story. But when I was in university, I went to the University of Pittsburgh and I got my undergraduate in chemical engineering. And I took some classes, a minor in petroleum engineering. And the classes I took in petroleum engineering really lit my fire. And I really enjoyed them. I really found them interesting. I truly was fascinated by it. And the job opportunities that came out from university, the one I took was to go work for Schlumberger Oilfield Services. And my first assignment was in Al Khobar, Saudi Arabia, 5 weeks after I graduated from Pittsburgh. Now, put this in perspective, this is a kid whose greatest international experience at that point was going to Niagara Falls at 19, right? So like literally landing in the Middle East, landing in Saudi Arabia, total cultural shock five weeks after graduation was quite the experience in life. So I did that for the first 2 years of my career. And then I was transferred to the Sultanate of Oman, which is just a little bit further south on the Arabian Peninsula. And then 9/11 happened. And of course, the whole world turned upside down. So at that point, my career was really interesting. So at that point, I actually had the opportunity to go work for Halliburton Oilfield Services out of Houston. And they put me on a global flying squad team of 6 guys. And we got to do new contract startup services. We got to do everything. Directional drilling, logging while drilling, measurements while drilling. We went all over the world. I worked Nigeria, Baku, Azerbaijan, Alaska, 2 winters. I worked in the United Kingdom. I worked on the Deepwater Horizon. I worked offshore Australia. I worked literally all over the planet. It was a whirlwind job, 4.5 years. And then I decided, you know what? I've really enjoyed it, but I want to go back to grad school. I want to get my technical understanding of what I'm doing further advanced in my career. So I went to Louisiana State University, started in January of 2007. And shortly after I got started there, I got hired by a company called Wild Well Control. Now, Wild Well Control was one of the 3 big oil well firefighting companies, like Kuwait in 1991, when Saddam Hussein pulled out of Kuwait and lit up all the wells, the scorched earth policy. And I'll circle back to that because I got an interesting story about that. So I actually went to work for them, and I thought I traveled a lot with Halliburton. Well, I had a lot to learn. I still had a lot more travel when I went to work for Wild Well Control. But it really gave me the opportunity, while I finished my graduate studies and also the sharpening of my technical sword, that I really became a global expert in well control and oil well firefighting, which then, of course, was a whirlwind in and of itself, because literally 2 years later, I got called to BP's office. By BP to go start, help them with the morning after the Deepwater Horizon blew out. And so I spent 140 days working at their office, and I did everything from the flow rate calculations to the top kill operations to both relief wells design and execution, even including the subsea capping design and eventually the actual static kill operation, which ended the worst oil spill in the U.S. Gulf of Mexico's history. And then shortly after that, I did a massive job that was not documented and doesn't exist in the archives in East Texas in Panola County. And funny enough that when I was living in Houston at the time, going back and forth to Panola County to this incident, I was actually always driving through Polk County. I was going up 59. And I eventually decided to stop and take a look at the lake and start looking at ideas. And I really kind of fell in love with the area. And I said, you know what? It's one of these days. I'm going to live up here. Well, in 2017, when I finally sold the house in Houston, I moved up here full time. So 2013, I bought the farm. And then 2017, I actually moved up here full time. So one of the things that was really interesting was that after I finished this big underground blowout in East Texas, it was also my first run-in with the Railroad Commission, because the Railroad Commission blamed the operator Unfortunately, I'm still under confidentiality agreement, so I can't get into a lot of technical specifics about what happened and the scope of issues. But I guess someday when I'm the railroad commissioner, I can. But I would say that the interesting thing was that the railroad commission's perception was that it was the operator's fault for something that was designed 30 years prior to the saltwater injection. And they blamed the operator for causing the issue when it was really the railroad commission's inability to manage the saltwater disposal correctly in East Texas. Now, remember, this was 4 years before the big incidents in Oklahoma in 2014, 2015. So the problem was already existing in East Texas even before the Permian problem really began to turn online. Well, I finished that, and then I went to work for, just kind of wrap up the story here, I went to work for Chevron. I started my own company, and I went to work for Chevron in the Deepwater Gulf of Mexico unit in downtown Houston. Then I started my own well control company on top of that, which I started doing work in Mexico, in the United Kingdom. And it was kind of neat. Now I'm my own boss. I've got my own team. We're doing our own stuff. And then unfortunately, at 40 years old, I had a heart attack. And I actually got life flighted off the rig in the middle of the North Sea on October 17th of 2015 and had a 99% blockage. And yep. And I ended up having a stent installed at 40 years old, courtesy of NHS. And I tell folks that you want to talk about an eye opener. Yeah. I have a heart attack at 40, right? So after that really, truly changed everything. I decided that, you know, this idea of living on this road and kind of being this firefighter and this whole mentality of things, I wanted to change. I had at that time, she was a year old daughter. And I said, you know what, things have got to be reprioritized in my life. I got a lot of things to clean up and sort out. So I kind of said, you know, I sold off the company, closed out the partnerships and kind of got things sorted out. Made my change up to the Livingston, Texas at that point and kind of went on about life and started with my patent. I'm also a U.S. patent holder in a carbon-free technology to create hydrogen. And very interesting long story on that too, but it's I'm officially a U.S. patent holder on hydrogen technology. And then really my career broadened because at that point I started looking at things from a different perspective of one post Macondo, my career focus became more about prevention. I wanted to see things be different. I wanted to change the way the industry tackled things without it always having to be, that's somebody else's fault. It was somebody else's career. I wanted the industry to really change fundamentally. And of course, this is probably one of the hardest industries to change. It has a tendency to do it the way we've always done it because it's always worked. So I got really frustrated to be perfectly honest with the way things were very slow to come about and things didn't really change. And I kind of said I had enough. It was a great career, great adventure. And then I got dragged to North Africa. So I ended up in Adrar, North Africa, actually just from Ragan, Algeria, where the French tested one of their very first nuclear weapons. We were drilling gas wells, very high pressure gas wells out in the Algerian desert. And the company at the time needed my expertise and knowledge. And I said, okay, I'll go do it. I did some consulting work. Every once in a while, I pick up a little work here and there. I mean, it's kind of like a drug addiction. You can't really fix it. You know, it's like, okay, you really need to go. Okay, I'll go, right? So I did some work in West Texas. I got to see some of the Permian. I drilled some wells in Pecos County, and I did some work around Piote, and it was very interesting and very eye-opening to see kind of how bad things were really happening in West Texas. And then I got hired, of all things, surprise, surprise, I got hired by the Coites to become their drilling manager for their deep Jurassic gas projects right by the Kuwait-Iraq border. And I took the job, I took the contract, and I started there. And then lo and behold, COVID hit. So everything went completely upside down. And then the management team decided they wanted to try to illegally change the contracts. And ironically, I was one of the only, most of the people there took it because the risk of COVID and everything else. And I'm principled and I believe in integrity. And if somebody's going to try to screw you, to be honest, they're not really worth working for because they have no integrity and they're not a good group to work with. So I told them no, and I filed a lawsuit against them. And 2 years later, I finally won my labor case. So I'm a living proof of the purpose of good labor law and good labor contracts and taking care of your employees correctly. And I truly fundamentally believe in that, not only from the safety side of the business, but also from the contractual business side, that the whole reason we have unions is to protect workers from bad employers, not just to help unions, right? It's right. Really, truly to help protect the people workers. From yeah. the workers from bad employers.
Yeah.
Well, 2 years later, my case went to the Kuwait Supreme Court and I won. And I am one of the first expats that they can recall in modern history that has ever won a labor case in the Kuwaiti Supreme Court. And I held my guns to it. And I tell, a lot of the guys in the field are just truly astounded that I actually won that case. And I said, no, I said, because principally it was right. It was, you have to do the right thing. Sometimes it's the hardest thing to stand up and do, but you got to do the right thing. So during that period when I was dealing with the Kuwaiti lawsuit, Sarah Stogner, who ran for the Railroad Commission back in 2022, she's famous for her pump jack video. And I promised everybody I won't get on a pump jack during my campaign time. One of the things that was very interesting, still time. Yeah, no, I promise everybody, you don't have to worry about that for me. One of the interesting things was that she called me out to the Antina Cattle Company because I was in country. And she said, I need you to come out and really take a look at this. And I said, what do you need my skill set for these old wells out here in West Texas? This isn't the new stuff. This isn't the stuff I worked on in 2017 and 2018. Like, come on, this stuff is 50, 60, 70 years old. Like, the stuff's depleted. It's old. It's in crappy state. I was like, really? So she's like, yeah, you really need to come out and see this. And I said, all right. So I called my ex. I dropped my daughter off over at the Louisiana border, and I literally drove all afternoon, all evening to West Texas. Well, I ended up spending the whole entire summer of 2021 out at the Antina Cattle Company Ranch dealing with two of the very first zombie wells, these old plugged dead wells that are now back to life. And when I got done there, I realized the size and extent of the problem. Like, this wasn't just two random wells that had sprung back to life. Like, this was thousands of wells in this 500 plus thousand acre area that's bigger than the city of Houston. I mean, if you put it in perspective, Houston's 426,000 acres, and this is like 500,000 plus acres already that are flowing at surface, contaminating the groundwater, and is an absolute train wreck environmentally. Some of them are leaking hydrocarbons in terms of oil flowing at surface or methane at surface, but they're flowing this radioactive isotope laden produced water at surface. And I was like, wow, this is unbelievable. So I went to the Railroad Commission's office and I tried to sit down with Wayne Christian and try to really get them. He was the only one who would take the meeting. And unfortunately, he blew it off. So I got his chief of staff and the chief engineer for the Railroad Commission and general counsel. And I advised them of the severity of the risk and get ahead of the narrative and really try to start to address the root causes, try to get diagnostics, try to do forensics to figure out what's happening. They got to put money and resources at this. This problem is going to only get worse. Now, the earthquake problem, as you kind of mentioned, has been ongoing since 2009. The SMU and the University of Texas Geosciences Department has been studying the earthquakes in Reeves County and Pecos County. And there is a direct correlation to the volume of water being injected and the timeline of the events. And the magnitudes are not only the more frequent, but the magnitudes are getting significantly stronger. I know you've heard me say this on the campaign trail, but three of the five biggest earthquakes in the state of Texas's history have occurred in the last 18 months. And y'all in El Paso have felt them. I mean, everything from Amarillo to Austin, all the way to Alpine, have felt these earthquakes. And again, we are at a tipping point. Ironically, some of my colleagues in Oklahoma who work for the OCC have suggested that Texas was 5 years ago was at a tipping point of no return. And they're convinced that we're 5 years too late. And they might be right. But regardless, we have to do something to address the issues of what's happening in the oil field in West Texas. And unfortunately, it's not just West Texas, because that discussion I had with you about Panola County in East Texas, those problems are also continuing to increase. There's still problems with water being brought over the border from Louisiana dumping into East Texas, Oklahoma's dumping across the northern side of the state, and New Mexico's dumping across into West Texas. So literally, we're the toxic dumping grounds for three other states' problems on top of our own production problem, which we're still drilling more wells and we're still producing more water and we're still pumping more water into the ground. So we have this really interesting problem now of how do you begin to address the 70 plus year legacy of these old wells like the Antina Cattle Company Ranch and these old wells drilled 1940, 50, 60. And how are we going to re-enter, find them, plug them again? And unfortunately, this is a game of whack-a-mole because every time you plug one, another one over here pops up because the pressure increases and the water finds a different pathway to flow to. And it's, you're constantly seeing these changes as we're plugging out more wells in West Texas. But we are in a situation now where I'm not totally sure how we're going to really, truly, if the Railroad Commission continues to kick the can down the road, I'm convinced their ultimate plan is just to turn the vast majority of the state into a toxic Superfund site. And unfortunately, the earthquakes will get to a certain point where the water will break through all the way to surface. And then we'll end up with a Great Salt Lake of basically toxic radioactive isotope water flowing at surface. And we started to see the first symptoms of that on December 7th this last year, when that first well broke through from 600 feet all the way to surface on its own. We still don't know how it flowed all of a sudden from 600 feet to surface. The Railroad Commission supposedly plugged it, although nobody actually was there to witness and verify what they did and how they did it. But we know they spent $2.5 million of taxpayer money to get it sorted in 6 weeks, which a professional well control company would have done a lot faster. So nobody really knows the magnitude of what's happening, but this area around Crane County, Pecos County, Ward County is really, truly ground zero for the imminent disaster that is building. And, you know, the long story short for me was that I was able with the Coit settlement and the contract settlement to afford the time to spend a year to really, truly hold the Railroad Commission's feet to the fire to try to address these issues. And you know, whether I win or lose the election come November, the reality is that I'm going to highlight the scenario of where we are in the state of Texas to everybody so that people are no longer being told a false narrative of, oh, everything's fine, drill, baby, drill, and there's no worries to be had about anything. No, we have real issues. We have real environmental issues. We have real groundwater contamination. This isn't just as simple as, you know, hey, these earthquakes are one-off events. Don't have to worry about it. These earthquakes are going to get worse. And again, we have to address the saltwater production problem and how we're injecting this back into the earth for disposal.
Yeah. that was
I know it's a lot.
It was great. And then there was so much. So we have covered, we've touched on a bunch of different things. And I know that I've got, because the whole reason I started this podcast was so that I could get people engaged and more informed and involved, that even the people who are, like, you know, pretty fairly engaged might be voting in every triple D Democrats. You ask them at the door, what does the railroad commissioner do? And I bet you a good amount of them are going to say railroads. So before we go on, why don't you give us an overview? What exactly is the railroad commissioner's job?
So the railroad commissioner's job is fundamentally to regulate the natural energy supply in the state of Texas and make sure it safely gets to market. Now, the Railroad Commission is a very complex agency because historically, in 1891, when it was founded, it was to regulate the railroad industry, which was an unregulated industry. Think about it like different track sizes and different connections and different protocols. So it was a way to actually regulate transport and commerce on the rails. And obviously, you know, the rail line robbers, right? The old black and white, you know, you can think your old Western movies, right? You know, they're robbing the stagecoach and things kind of like that, right? So they actually really did have those issues. So one of the things that was, as we discovered in 1901, Spindletop and oil began to become more abundant supply in the state of Texas, we began to export it. And so one of the easiest ways to move a large volume of rail at that time was not in rail cars, but it was actually in wooden barrels. So the barrels were 42 gallons in a barrel, not the 55 gallons. And we moved volumes based on barrels, literally of oil, every day out of Texas. So we moved them on the rail. So the Railroad Commission, by definition, became the agency that, in essence, ended up with the oil and gas industry because of the transportation side of the house. Now, as oil and gas production increased in the 1940s, it really began to stand up on its own. The industry itself became a much larger entity from the 1900s to 1940, 1950. And then obviously during the 1960s and 70s, post-World War II, the energy infrastructure of America has totally changed. The United States infrastructure changed. Oil and gas became a major commodity. Refiners got set up. We started building large refineries. And again, the Royal Commission's input to make sure we stabilize the oil price is it rationed the oil supply side to make sure things were perfectly got to market, really was a critical agency. And then ironically, it's actually when OPEC sat up, a lot of people don't know this, but OPEC actually modeled itself based on the Texas Royal Commission. Kind of an interesting little detail in history. Mm-hmm. So in the 1970s and 80s, when we got really into now this OPEC versus the Texas Royal Commission kind of battle, OPEC obviously being a much larger nation, group of nations and structure and commoditization, really fundamentally controlled the global oil supply. But the Texas Royal Commission was the U.S. manager, basically, of the vast majority of our production, which was United States-based oil. And then it was interesting because when I joined the industry in 2000, a lot of the future of oil production was deepwater Gulf of Mexico. And so everybody was doing offshore drilling and bigger projects and producing more oil from the Gulf. But when the shale revolution started in 2004 with the very first wells outside of Dallas and then kind of ramped its way up into 2008 in the Permian, really the boom, the complete change of the U.S. economic policy and energy policy changed because of the Permian. And the Royal Commission now is back forefront of being the agency that literally runs the largest U.S. single supply side of 6 million barrels a day of production from the state of Texas. And, you know, that's one of the things that people don't realize is that this is one of the most powerful agencies in the United States. The Texas Royal Commission only controls 8% of our gross national product of Texas, but it's 2.2 million jobs, $26 billion worth of royalties. It is the agency that is probably the largest input on our environmental stewardship in the state of Texas in terms of emissions and groundwater protection and pollution. This is the agency that controls the direction and state of Texas. And one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that, you know, during Winter Storm Uri 2 years ago, the Railroad Commission was the agency that was really at fault for the failure of winterizing the natural gas lines in 2011. When they were told to make sure you start to identify critical infrastructure and make sure you get things winterized, they refused because they said, well, take away too much profit from our gas producers. And why would we want to do that? You know, and 10 years later, when it actually did happen, you notice how all the blame got shifted to ERCOT. The Royal Commission didn't take any accountability for its actual failures, but it was the agency that was actually charged with making sure the natural gas supply from the wells got to the producers who needed to convert it to electricity. Therefore, there's nothing they can do, and they don't have the supply side to actually get the turbines to continue to turn to actually get the electricity to the market. So it really, a lot of people don't realize the impact of how much power and how much influence and reach the Texas Royal Commission has. And again, because the name is the worst named agency in the state of Texas, it's allowed to be the worst run agency in the state of Texas. But really, it comes down to the two efforts that have been there to try to change the name have both been blocked by Senator Tom Craddock, who is in the Texas Senate. And he has a personal pet mission to make sure that the name change doesn't evolve, that it stays as the oldest agency. And I get the desire to maintain the historical legacy, but it doesn't reflect correctly for what the agency really is remitted to do, which is to manage our natural energy supply side. So for me, you know, there's 1.2 plus million oil wells drilled in the state of Texas. And I say that because we've lost a ton of records. There's a lot of records that were lost or filed. There's a fire one point in the Royal Commission's agency's history. There's probably 200,000-400,000 more wells that exist that we actually don't have records for anymore. We call them ghost wells. They're also coming back to life, which is... I'm not sure what you call a dead ghost that comes back to life. I'm not sure if that's a zombie ghost. Yeah, what's that going to look like? And then we also have the problem of we have 330,000 miles of installed pipelines, of which a lot of lines are abandoned. And unfortunately, when they were abandoned, they never emptied the lines of their contents. So there's lots of long-term legacy issues and risks in the state of Texas. But the legacy problems are going to be there for another century, and we do have to correctly identify and start to tackle them. And 253 of 254 counties have oil and gas wells drilled in them. Y'all are the only county in the state. I always tell people, it's a good bar trivia question, that El Paso County has never had an oil and gas well drilled in it. So congratulations. But you also have a ton of pipelines, so you're not totally out of the system. And then the other thing is that really what's happening now, and the real crisis that's really brewing, is this produced water problem. Because these Permian wells that we brought on in 2008, we really should call them water wells that produce associated oil and gas, and not oil and gas wells that produce associated water. Because for every barrel of oil that we get out of the ground on these wells, we get 5 or 6 barrels of this toxic periodic table soup of metals, and also the radioactive isotopes that come with it as well. And this stuff is at least 3 times saltier than seawater. And then on top of the contents of the cadmium and mercury and lead and zinc, and it's got lithium, and it's got copper and nickel and vanadium and other rare earth metals. This stuff is nasty, and it will kill even mesquite, which does take a bit of Roundup. If you really want to kill mesquite, you can just put a little bit of toxic produced water on it, and mesquite's dead. So stuff is nasty. And it is a challenge because we produce so much volume of it per day. And plus, we're taking the other 3 states' problems across the borders that what are you going to do with it? So the issues that we have now is that the saltwater disposal wells, these we call SWDs, we just continue to drill more and more and more of them because the rate of water ramped up. And then they started doubling and tripling the rates of injection into these wells for disposal to try to help compensate for not having to drill more wells. There's something like 19,000 saltwater disposal wells installed. And there's a couple maps online that shows the size and extent of the saltwater disposal wells, and they're all over the state of Texas. So the earthquakes are a result. And again, there's a lot of arguments on the geophysics of kind of what's the true mechanisms and causations. And look, I'm not looking to get my PhD in geosciences. But from what I understand, you know, the idea of all this additional water is either lubricating old faults that existed and causing them to slip, or the pressure regimes are exceeding the ability for the rock to actually contain it, and is allowing the water to flow elsewhere. And when it breaks, causes earthquakes. Whatever these mechanisms are, they're happening all over. We're seeing them in East Texas. We're seeing them in South Texas. In fact, the other day in South Texas, just southeast of San Antonio, there was a 4.1 magnitude event from the Eagleford. And in the last 14 days, there's been 13 earthquakes in that region. So, you know, we talk about West Texas, but here's a case in you know, southeast Texas, southeast Texas, because that's more my side of the state. Really, southeast of San Antonio towards the Rio Grande Valley, there really is a whole series of earthquakes that are occurring. And again, there's massive earthquakes in all of West Texas. So we got to get these resolved. Because you're, as you correctly said, homes in Texas were never built for seismic activity. And, you know, it's one thing when you have 2.0, 3.0 magnitudes. Okay, the house rattles for a little bit. Maybe you get a minor crack in a sheetrock. 4.0, you'll start breaking windows. Dishes will start falling. You'll start seeing the chandelier swinging. 5.0s, you'll start to see major structural, the early signs of structural damage on houses. 6.0, you start to flatten structures. 7.0, you start to watch roads and bridges and everything else collapse, right? So we do not need to get to a point of having 6 and 7.0 magnitude earthquakes in Texas because of the saltwater injection. So the idea that the Railroad Commission has allowed this blind injection of all this produced water. And look, we had the problem in Oklahoma in 2014, 2015, with the big earthquake under the Cushing oil reserve. Oklahoma's answer at the time was to shut in production and then eventually build pipelines to the western side of Oklahoma to then dump the water into western Oklahoma, which, you know, unfortunately, even though Texas is a really big place, we're putting water in all 3 sides of the state. So I'm not sure what we're going to do really to manage that. There's always been the joke, well, we'll just send it across the border to Mexico. You know, again, that's not us. It's moving the problem to something else isn't going to solve this problem. So, The industry over the last 10 years has been quietly working on ways to recycle this water, take out the fresh water, split out the salts, recover some of the metals. There's all these different technologies and groups that have been working on this. And the problem with our industry, like I said earlier, is that we are, well, it's the way we've always done it, so why would I want to change? So we've always used it for disposal. So the vast majority of the answer is, well, why would I want to pay 50 cents more a barrel for disposal costs for when I could just do what I've always done for 50 cents? Why would I want to pay a dollar? Well, because you're offsetting the bigger problem, which is going to cost everybody major issues. And again, this is where the Rare Commission has truly fundamentally failed every single Texan, is that we've known this problem has been coming for literally a decade. And they have refused to address anything proactively in terms of trying to get ahead of this storyline. And so now everybody's backs are against the wall and the public outcry is starting to happen about, hey, earthquakes are not acceptable. Hey, groundwater contamination is not acceptable. Hey, these zombie wells are not acceptable. Y'all haven't plugged these wells correctly. Like, the Rare Commission now truly is dealing with its own karma of failure to actually regulate the industry. And I have to say that that's one of the things that have been on the campaign trail, that it's people have heard and have started to wake up to the realizations of what the Rare Commission really is and does, and the extent of its reach. People are really starting to realize the importance of why this is an executive level elected position in the state of Texas. You know, the ag commissioner, of course, because of Texas has so much ag and has so much value of ag, it makes sense that the head of the ag would be kind of an executive level position reporting to the governor, lieutenant governor. And same thing with general land office. You can kind of understand public lands, why the commissioner for that would be a very important role as well. We have a lot of public lands and a lot of issues and a lot of things to resolve. But yeah, the oil and gas side, the Railroad Commission really is an executive level position for the state of Texas. And unfortunately, usually when you get around to the election cycles, because the Rare Commission is every other cycle. So it's 2022, 2024, 2026. All the three commissioners that are up will be back up again. And then it repeats again for every 6-year cycle. So it's really one of those things that this is the rare election cycle with a presidential year that there's just enough oxygen in the room to have a conversation about what the Rare Commission is, and get people a little bit educated that it has nothing to do about railroads. This is really about our oil and gas industry.
And how is that going as you've been on the campaign trail? I mean, you've made it out to El Paso a couple of times, and there are state candidates who are running for big, big offices who don't make it out to El Paso. And so I'm really curious, because you travel all over the place. You know, how is it resonating? How are people resonating? And particularly, you know, because you are running as a Democrat, how are your conversations going with Republicans or more centrist voters?
So it's been really good. Event-wise, it's been fabulous. I've had a chance to do everything from Dallas to Lubbock to, of course, El Paso. I've been down in the Valley. I've been through San Antonio, of course, Houston area in East Texas. Although I will say, having to do two events back-to-back from El Paso to Beaumont was a little rough. That was a little rough to get between the two of it in the day. I mean, you know, it's a little bit of time on I-10. You know, it is what it is. But I will say I've really enjoyed it. It has. I love the industry. I've enjoyed having the conversation and teaching. I enjoy teaching anyways. When I was a grad student, a little fun trivia story that my professor actually took a sabbatical. And that semester class was a drilling fluids class. And since I'd worked in the industry and been in the industry for 6 years, he asked me if I wanted to teach. And so actually, as my last year of graduate studies, I actually got to teach the undergraduate class in drilling fluids. It was a lab, a 1-credit-hour lab, but first time that a grad student had actually taught a actual undergraduate class in years and years and years. And it was really fun. So I've enjoyed the opportunity to teach and explain. And it, that part of it for me, being on the campaign trail and talking about the Rare Commission and talking about the industry and telling people, you know, it's not apocalyptic. I know it sounds bad in a lot of ways, but
I mean, I feel like it's apocalyptic after half an hour. I feel like the world's ending.
Well, and it, you know, and unfortunately for me, a lot of that is just getting the facts on the table of these are the scenarios. This is the real reality of what, these are the problems we have to address. This isn't sugarcoating it and saying, look, it's great and hydrocarbons do this and that and our lifestyles are greater for it. No, I get all that. And yes, that is all true. But in the same token, I also want us to really focus on what is it that we need to do different? What is it that we need to truly change in the state of Texas? And this is why I'm running, is we need to address the earthquakes and the saltwater production problem. We got to deal with the zombie wells and the legacy issues. And then we got to deal with how we're going to grow our energy system to get through to the next century, because nobody in the state thinks this is going to be smaller. So for me, the traveling side has been, again, I'm as an oil well firefighter, I'm used to living out of my truck. It's actually nice because I get to go to a hotel and actually shower between, you know, jobs. And I'm not actually sleeping in the back of my truck while I'm sitting on location. And I'm not eating dinners every night at a 7-Eleven, you know, with Vienna sausages and saltines. So, you know, it's a lot better lifestyle being a traveling road as a politician than as an oil well firefighter. But I will say that skill set, and I've said this to a lot of other people, have said, like, how in the hell do you manage this level of travel and experience and doing this with the dog and this and that? Because it's just like oil well firefighting. Like, I'm in crisis mode. You know, you get up in the morning, 5:30 in the morning, 6. Coffee's done and I'm off to work, and 9-10 o'clock at night I'm wrapping it up and heading to bed, and I'm back up next morning, and what happened yesterday is put in the notebook and tally book and figure out what you need to do different and get after it. And this is that same 200 mile an hour bullet train lifestyle that I did when I was an oil well firefighter, so it doesn't bother me. But for a lot of other folks, I can see where it's a remarkable different lifestyle to compartmentalize, like shut things off at the house and say, like, okay, I won't be back for I don't know how long. So how do you do this and how do you do that? Right. You have to learn to live on the road, really. So I've enjoyed that part very, very, very well. I've had a couple events with the kind of a mixed audience of Republicans and Democrats. And I have to say, when I talk about the issues, I talk about the groundwater, I talk about the environment, it resonates because energy is a nonpartisan topic. I mean, everybody, regardless of your party affiliation, should have the right to electricity, affordable and usable energy, reasonable gas prices, affordable natural gas at the house. Like, this is what we should all be striving for in the state of Texas, where we have such a plentiful, abundant resource to be able to use domestically. And yet we have some of the highest energy prices, which, again, because of our current system and how our government manages our design, we're at its breaking point. So one of the things in particular for me is being an engineer and really looking at the future, one of the things I think the Railroad Commission really needs to be responsible for is helping us truly frame out what the future plan for the energy system is going to look like to get to the turn of the next century, how we're going to mix that, how we're going to continue to decarbonize it, how we're going to continue to grow our resources. And again, in that same token, how we're going to protect the groundwater and manage groundwater for the expansions of the Austin and San Antonio and Houston and Dallas-Fort Worth and El Paso and Midland, Odessa, and all these areas that are going to get larger. Groundwater is going to be a major issue. So we're going to have to really look a lot at, and if we have to get into major cleaning expenses for a lot of our legacy, well, guess what? That all takes a hell of a lot more energy. So we're even going to have to use more energy to make sure the water's clean. So to me, I look at it as like it's a huge engineering project. It's a huge grand engineering challenge once I'm elected to really start to take and tackle the three phases of it. The first is obviously the saltwater production problem, the legacy issues. And then as we're working on the legacy issues, how we're moving forwards in the new designs and new elements and changing maybe some regulatory issues if we need to do better protections for groundwater. For me, the nonpartisan message, the centrist message, seems to resonate very well. The Republicans that have been in my audience and have talked and have listened have all come back and said, wow, like, you really do know what you're talking about. You're and again, I get the fact that there's a lot of differences in folks when it comes to maybe their positions on, oh, I don't know, stupid things like school vouchers or, you know, people have a hard time understanding that, oh, I don't know, abortion is healthcare. But in the oil field and in this conversation for energy, we're not really in that spectrum. So one of the things in particular is that when these messages are really more about all Texas, this is about Texans, this is about us taking care of our problems and figuring out our future, that resonates very well on both sides of the aisle. And I think that's the real key to this come November, is that not only has the Railroad Commissioners shot themselves in their own foot for their inability to address and manage this, but really the fact that this is being explained correctly, I think people are really are enjoying hearing the fact that this isn't a crazy narrative of the left or the right. You know, both sides are wrong, perfectly honest. The ultra left of carbon's bad, we're destroying the world, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, but then it's like, okay, but we still use petrochemical-based products for plates and plastics and pharmaceuticals, and that's still fossil fuel-based. I can agree with the decarbonization of the transportation sector and certainly the home and commercial sectors. I can totally agree with the decarbonization of those much, much further. But it's like, yeah, but then we're giving up plastics. Like, there's a lot of things about plastics that are very useful in our lifestyle. Like, you know, that's a hard one. So both sides, we have to really have a much more educated conversation about energy. And that's another thing. Like, when I get into some of those conversations with folks that hear like, okay, your position as a Democrat, I'm having a hard time having a cognitive dissonance that you're a Democrat who's actually talking about positive things with energy, because that's not the narrative they're being told. Mm-hmm. Every Democrat is anti-fossil fuel and out to destroy the entire Texas lifestyle 100%. And I'm like, no, that's not correct. We need to do it better. We need to have better environmental protections, and we need to really look at how to use our resources much more wisely in terms of not flaring off a billion cubic feet a day of natural gas because we're too lazy to capture it and use it for another day or find another way to use it, right? So to me, I think when we have these conversations and people see that, they start to resonate and say, okay, like, A, you know what you're talking about, and B, you're actually level-headed and having a practical conversation about it. So it's gone over very well, I think. We'll see more after the primary.
No, absolutely. Well, definitely. And I do have a question for you on the primary. But before that, you know, you talked about how there is science going into the recycling the water. That was something that I was going to ask, if there's something that we could do with the water. So I'm going to shift the question a little bit. And of the things that you've seen or heard, or, you know, what's being worked on, is there something that seems feasibly realistic, like in the near future, that makes you excited, like for how close that it could be, that could be very useful for, you know, to do with that water?
Yeah. So the real thing with the water is going to be to change the entire storyline of access to clean, fresh water. Because, for example, with the waste heat that we generate from the flaring operations in West Texas, we could be boiling water. We could be turning that into steam, cooling it down and condensing it back into fresh water and moving that fresh water in San Antonio, Austin for agricultural purposes. Like, there's nothing wrong with using that heat correctly for its purpose. And yet the industry has just simply said, wow, it's not a problem we're solving. Yeah, it actually is. Not only is the earthquake problem, but yeah, actually it is. We actually do have to come up with better ways to having access to fresh water for the growth of West Texas, even into San Antonio and Austin. So the water recycling technology really is going to be the key to really not only the future of where we're headed in Texas, but it's also going to be the key to the success of the oil and gas industry, which really is the funny thing is that neither side sees it yet, which is what I think I'm most excited about, is that the oil and gas industry is finally acknowledging, okay, we've got a real problem. The public sentiment is going against us with the earthquakes and the saltwater production problems and the contamination issues, but they haven't seen the win yet. They haven't seen that reputational win of like, hey, our waste product is now actually a usable commodity that makes people happy that we actually have access to fresh water. I mean, I don't know if we need to build gigantic Schlitterbahn water parks out in, you know, Midland, Odessa for people to come and visit and make it a water destinations, you know, water park, you know, to get people to realize that we'll have an access here very soon. But you know, that's where we're headed. And to me, I'm really, really excited to see that when the industry finally gets around, and it will be solved, because again, it's critical to the oil and gas production side, that it's going to really truly change the state of Texas, and it's coming quickly. We don't have time to continue to let the earthquakes get worse to eventually then say, okay, well, maybe now we got to do something about it. Like, we're already at that point. So I'm really excited to see as we start ramping this up in the next 2 years, and we start getting more and more scale of recycling accomplished, and people start to see the real impact, then it will be a snowball effect as it really starts to grow further. You know, to put this in perspective, and I try to explain to people that we handle in West Texas in water volume a day what the city of Houston uses all across the whole entire city in a year. So we could build 365 city of Houstons to literally run the amount of water that we manage a day in West Texas. Yeah. So there's a bit of water to put back out into the area. And, you know, again, there's also mineral mining. I mean, there's opportunities to get lithium and copper and vanadium and cobalt and all other kinds of metals that are in this water. And of course, there are some other things in the water we got to deal with. But I think there's really a future in this commodity to look at the fact that we have the ability and the technology to be able to really fundamentally change living in Texas. And especially knowing the droughts and climate change are real, water is one of those issues that's going to be a real major changer for a game changer for everybody. And I think that when that eureka moment finally happens in the next couple of years, it's going to be a big surprise for everybody.
I'm looking forward to that. You have talked about, you know, thinking about the general November election, but you are in a primary right now. You are in a contested primary, but you are racking up endorsements. And, you know, I know there's people listening who say endorsements don't win elections, but I mean, it's hard to see one candidate that is racking up so much support and then another candidate in that same party that isn't pulling in that same support. So I'd like to give you the opportunity to why do you think that is? Explain to the to listeners why so many people are behind you.
Well, first and foremost, I mean, you know, my Democratic opponent is not a Democrat. And, you know, let's call a spade in this situation. She's a lifetime Republican. She grew up in New York and she lived in Massachusetts and then moved to Houston in 2015. And she has voted in every single Republican primary since she was 18, never missed one. It's since moving to Houston in 15, she voted in the 16, 18, 20, 2022 and 2022 primary runoff as a Republican. So it's look, if she's coming across the party recently and wants to become a Democrat, great. You know, welcome aboard. Glad to have you. Glad to see you finally. You finally dusted off the red hat and threw it in the burn bin. Congratulations. Right. But when you ask her the question of like, why are you a Democrat? She can't answer it. She's not clear. It's like, it's not reproductive rights. It's not an argument of, you know, I'm angry about how the system works. Like, there's nothing. There's no reasonable answer as to why she's a Democrat. And then the second thing that really gets me is that when we've had conversations about her voting history and the debates that's been brought up several times, she says, well, you know, in the North, Republicans are just like Democrats, and there's really no difference in the two parties in New York and Massachusetts. And I'm like, well, that's ludicrous, because I grew up in Pennsylvania, and there was a hell of a lot of difference between Republicans and Democrats in Pennsylvania. But okay, if that's the same, then she says, but since moving to Houston in 2015, in the Democratic primaries, none of the Democrats are ever have an opponent. So it's, what's the point of voting for a Democrat when they don't have any primary opponents? And I'm like, huh? I'm like, Hillary Clinton had opponents in 16. Roman McAllen had opponents in his railroad commission race in 18. Krista Castaneda had like three opponents in her case in the statewide race. Beto had opponents in 2022. Like, what are you talking about? Like, everybody at the statewide level, okay, maybe not in your local, you know, sheriff's race in Harris County, maybe was unopposed, or local precinct was unopposed. But like, when you look at the overall ballot from 16, 18, 20, and 22, like, yeah, there were actually people who had primary challengers. So like, what are you talking about? So then it's when it dawned on me that she really doesn't, she really isn't a Democrat, because she would have known that these people were not just, they weren't just unopposed candidates across the board. And then she made a crazy statement about the fact that, you know, the only way to really vote for your leadership in Texas is to vote Republican. And I'm like, yeah, because you're a Republican. Like, because the rest of us who are Democrats know that the Republicans are still going to maybe win in some of these races, but we still vote Democrat because we don't want to vote for the Republicans. Like, it's really crazy to me to hear those stories. So I know for some folks in some of the endorsements that has been, and have heard her story and heard her positions, have called her out for it and won't support her based on that. But the other thing is that when it came down to a lot of conversations and such, she has no background in being progressive. None of her positions are supportive of any of the social issues. She never talks about abortion and healthcare. She never talks about LGBTQ plus issues. She never talks about diversity and inclusion in the oil field. She doesn't talk about any of the social issues at all. And I'm like, look, I get it's a nonpartisan race, right? I get the fact that, you know, the ideas of a lot of the social gun control and other issues that you would identify as being a, you know, I don't know, maybe people have the right to vote, and maybe people have the right to have, make their own choices on their bodily autonomy, and right, you know, all these other things. She never brings them up. And when you get to a lot of these questionnaires and you talk a lot about the positions, like, what would you do to help support, you know, the disabled community? she's not interested. It's like, well, they can't work in the oil field. Yeah, but there's lots of opportunities to use their minds and lots of opportunities to use them, use the folks in the disabled community to be a part of our community and work in energy. It's the same thing with our a lot of the scenarios of our workforce when we look at, you know, no offense to myself, but, you know, when I go to the oil field, a lot of people look like me, right? There's not necessarily always the best diversity inclusion in hiring practices. And look, like I've said, I'm happy to see women involved in politics and in the energy conversation. And I would love to see more equal representation of our communities working in energy, because again, it's a nonpartisan field. I want to see more people to think from different backgrounds and be a part of this industry. But she doesn't bring any of the social issues up. And when it came to, I think, a lot of the conversations and such, I was really surprised to see that she just refused to participate. Things like the Dallas Morning News, they reached out to her 4 or 5 times. She never replied back. She never filled out the questionnaire. She didn't want to be endorsed by the Dallas Morning News. She had an interview with the Austin Chronicle and she didn't even show up to it. Like, there are things about it that I don't understand why she got into this race, to be perfectly honest. And I'm not trying to be disparaging, but maybe it was more than she wanted to bite off and chew, but it's like, you know, when it comes down to the importance of an executive level position, you really have to do the work. You really have to travel. You have to get out there and see rural Texas. You know, at one point she was asked a question in Houston at an event, like in early January, like, how do you plan on covering all 254 counties? And she said, who cares? Rural Texas doesn't vote. They don't matter. And I'm like, what? Like, yeah, I live in Polk County. I live in rural Texas. Like, you better believe we vote. You better believe we matter. I mean, I get it. We're not maybe 1 out of every 6 voters lose in Harris County, but you're not going to win Houston to win the entire state of Texas. You've got to support Collin County and Travis County and Bexar County and El Paso County and Lubbock County. And you got to get over to Jefferson County. Like, there are areas and down through the valley, in the Rio Grande Valley, you have to go down to Cameron County and visit. Like, there is really strong Democratic circles here that you really need those support through the primary. I was shocked. I was truly shocked to see that she just did not seem to understand the Texas politics side. So at the end of the day, you know, I'm grateful. I mean, I think I've won like 24 endorsements and like 4 of the major newspaper endorsements. It's literally a clean sweep. Mm-hmm. But the thing that gets me is that it's not, I'm not saying that bragging or boastful. It's just the fact that it's like, why did you get into this race? Why are you running? It makes me, you know, I'm comfortable in my skills. I know my knowledge. I know where I'm at. And if I can get that out to the voters, that's really where I think people see the difference between her and I. Mm-hmm. But what gets me is on some of the conversations that I've heard. Unfortunately, we have a lot of voters who sometimes do look at the gender bias as their preference in primaries. And, you know, of course, it's still a concern because I could still lose the primary, even with all the endorsements and all the backing, because mm-hmm. the gender bias. Mm-hmm. But I really, really hope that people have done their homework, seen my background, my credentials, the technicals, what I'm talking about, mm-hmm. the importance of this agency, and realize that this is a race you need to have done your homework on. This is number 4 on the ballot. It's the only executive position in 2024. This one really is going to make the difference in the state of Texas.
Absolutely. Where can people go to learn more about you if they want to donate, if they want to reach out to you, ask any questions? Drop all your info.
Sure. So first and foremost, you can go to the website, Burch, B-U-R-C-H, 4TRRC.com. First and foremost, you can always send an email at info@burch.com. That will get straight to the campaign team. I tell everybody that, you know, it's just myself, Liz, Carla, and Jason. So the 4 of us, and we're running a statewide campaign. We're going to have to expand that out just a little bit more because mm-hmm. 4 folks is 254 counties. It's a little hard to do.
That's interesting.
We're a grassroots campaign. Yes, it is. We're a grassroots campaign. We're doing it the old school way. I'm doing it in person. We're doing a lot of events. We're trying to do as many meet and greets as we can, and we are traveling to events. So especially social media, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, I'm doing the social media. So if you don't like my spelling or wording, just let me know, because that's all me. I can't complain to somebody else about doing that. That's all mine. And you know, the biggest thing is that our Act Blue account, our donate page, we really do need the support financially as well. If you're able to donate, our donate page is right on our homepage. You can also go to Act Blue's site, search for Bill Birch. It will come up for the Texas Road Commission, and you can go and also donate directly through Act Blue. One of the things in this race that I've told folks that I really have not taken is oil and gas money. And one of the things in particular is that I don't want to be like our current commissioners, who it would seem do have a lot of quid pro quo for donations and making choices and decisions, right? So I do need the support of Texans to understand. I do need the financial support to pay for travel, but also mostly for the printing materials. It's not even the travel expenses as much as it really is the cost of yard signs and printing and advertising and really the traditional mainstream media capacity of some television, maybe some radio spots here and there, right? Especially in the general. You know, and look, the gubernatorial race in 2022 was $290 million spent between Beto and Governor Abbott. And I tell folks, like, look, I'm not even working on 1% of that budget. I'm not even going to get $3 million. Like, reality of this executive level position is going to have to be done grassroots, bare bone, and it's really going to need the support of Texans to really make this work. So if you can donate, and if you can't donate, if you can volunteer, I legitimately, in every single community I ask folks, I said, I totally get it. I get the fact that some candidates are focused only on money. I'm not one of those candidates that's focused solely on money. I get it's part of the game, but it's not part of the overall driver. I would rather see your ability to help us pass out literature, door knock, volunteer for calls, be part of our texting campaign. Find ways to get, even if you can't even do that, if you can just keep us in the loop on events or opportunities in your counties that are coming up that are larger audiences and we can have the opportunity to present our campaign, that's as great of help for me than it is for anything else. So that's the real strength of grassroots campaigning, getting the win and being the first Democrat elected to Texas in 30 years in an executive position. And that is the exciting part, really, for what this 2024 cycle will be, to break the glass ceiling, prove the fact that Texas has turned purple. I'll be elected in November, and then we have the opportunity to have a totally new conversation in 2026 about the governor, the lieutenant governor, the ag commissioner, and our public lands. So that is the importance of this race, not only for where we are today in Texas, but really the conversation about how we're going to get there in the future.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us this evening. If people want to reach out, I hope they do. I hope you will come back onto the show, you know, before November. I'd love to have you back on. There's still so much that you can teach and we could talk about. And what I am really, really looking forward to is that conversation closer after November and when you come back on and be like, okay, so it's actually way worse and this is what we're going to do. No, not really.
No, I think at this point, you know, when we get through the primary, the next real step is to start to drive the reach over to the centrist popular, the centrist independents, to start to realize the importance of these issues, that this isn't a partisan, this isn't just Democratic only driving conversation. And I'm really excited about seeing that, because as people start to see real action and they start to wake up to this, they start to say, oh yeah, maybe our current commissioners really aren't doing all the right things for the state of Texas. So I think that's going to be really fun to see as this rolls out, and groups like the Farm Bureau and a few others are starting to make their statements about they're not supporting their Republican candidates from the Rural Commission for how they've acted. That I think that there's a real opportunity here to change the entire paradigm after the primary. So let's see what happens, because Mrs. Craddock has four competitors on her Republican side. And there's no guarantees that even she gets through the primary. So that could be really, really interesting to see what happens after March 6th. So we'll see what comes up. But thank you again, Richard, for the opportunity. Really been great talking to you all tonight. And I look forward to coming back on. And we will definitely have a lot more interesting conversations coming up in the near future.
Once again, I'd like to thank Bill Birch for coming on to the El Paso Beat. He was phenomenal. His team got back to me right away because I have been off I've been off for the last few days. Of course, I've been very, very busy doing a whole bunch of different things over the last few days, but it worked out. And I was, you know, that I had a little bit of time, a window of time. And I reached out to them and I was like, hey, like, I think I can make this happen. I think I could get this episode released on President's Day, which is going to be right before early voting starts. It'd be great. I would love to have a, you know, to do a podcast because I enjoy doing it. Are you guys available at any point over the next couple of days? And then his team got back to me relatively quickly with a bunch of times. We found one that worked. Everything fell into place. Makes me feel all warm and fuzzy inside. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I picked up a whole lot from it. I also had kind of some anxiety-ridden sleep. You know, after the conversation, those earthquakes are no joke. It's a serious concern, and we need to... we have to reckon with the fact that this issue is here. You know, like he mentioned, you know, the state has experienced the majority of its major earthquakes in the last 18 months. And I'm kind of going that off the top of my head as I record this a couple of days after the conversation, a few hours before this will be posting. You know, it's real. I mean, you felt it. Those of you who felt the earthquake, you felt how real this is, and it's only going to get worse. And we actually have the opportunity to get out ahead of it, or at least as best as we can. Because like Bill said, this isn't a year where there's a lot of higher level offices at the top of the state ticket. There is more oxygen for the conversation of Railroad Commission to be had. And I don't know, you know, kind of, it's difficult not to glean a little bit of hope from that. But let me know what you think. Send me an email at theelpasobeat@gmail.com. I'd love to hear your feedback on what you think about Bill, the Railroad Commission, the giant mess that he's wading into. You know, yeah. And this was so fun. I missed this. I missed you guys. I mean, just trying to project in my head. Between now and March, I don't see myself doing a whole lot of interviews for the primary. I could foresee myself having a few interviews with, you know, runoff candidates. I guess if we get to anything, I would like to do runoff interviews with whoever the two candidates for sheriff are going to be. I think people would probably glean a lot from that. The Young Democrats actually opted not to endorse in the sheriff's race. There are several candidates, I think six or seven in total, but we only vetted three, the top three, we feel. And you know, it could be argued that you make an argument for just vetting the top two, but we really felt that there are three candidates who at any point, you know, are going to, could make it into the runoff. And so we vetted the three. We spoke with the three. I will say that the endorsement committee found things that they really liked about all three candidates, and they have some very valid concerns about all three candidates. It was the only race in which there was a real hesitancy about making a decision at all. And so I made an executive decision, and you know, I made more of an executive suggestion. And they took it, and I said, you know, we don't have to endorse. We don't have to make, a decision that we don't feel confident in. It's okay to say like, hey, like, let's just see how this plays out. And whoever is in the office, we are excited to have a relationship with the office. And, you know, having been a candidate who I won't say was snubbed on endorsements, but didn't get endorsements where I felt like I really should have or even could have. It is tough to be in a position where, like, you look for support, people say no, and then imagine yourself being in that position and those people coming back and being like, hey, we want this, 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 and this. And it's like, well, yeah, even if I'm going to give that to you, like, you know, you guys don't even like me. What is this relationship now? Like, you know, there really is no room for grudges in politics. It's just that humans don't work that way. And so I see value in us saying, we're going to take a step back. because there are things that we want to see improved with the sheriff's office. We feel that there are ways that the Young Dems can be involved and help push things forward. But if there is any kind of resistance because the person who got elected has, you know, grudge, it doesn't help anybody. And so, and for that, you know, you could argue, well, why endorse anybody then? Why make any endorsements? Well, you know, I feel that the average voter doesn't feel like they have enough time to vet candidates themselves. And a voter who cares enough to vote, but not enough to like sit down and really vet these candidates, really counts on some of these organizations to say, we'll do the work for you. We have been working beside these people. We have been, you know, listening to them and asking them questions. And we have made this decision to endorse this candidate on these merits. I will say that if you talk to the candidates, they like the Young Dems process the most because it was the most thoughtful, thorough, in-depth endorsement process. There are clubs, and I won't name names, and I won't really criticize because, you know, it's not my place to. There are clubs that it's just like all members vote, which is great. I think that has merits too. That's not exactly how the Young Dems did it. We have the endorsement committee that makes the decision and that carries. And I think there's value to that too for what we were trying to accomplish. But in other organizations, you know, they have the candidates come up, you get 2 minutes, make your case. And then at the end of the night, the members who are there, they're going to vote on who they liked and who they endorse. And the fact of the matter is that a lot of that comes with, you know, past this prologue, personal bias, you know, it's a popularity contest at some points. And how much of a service are you doing to the community if that's the way you're vetting? If that's like, you know, and I hear the frustration from some folks who feel like that's not worth it. But you know, it's just one big mess and we're all just trying to find our way through it. And I am proud of what the Young Dems did, and we will do it mostly like this in the future. We'll just be a lot more prudent about reaching out earlier and scheduling interviews earlier and having conversations earlier so that we're not endorsing like a week before early voting, which is what ended up happening, which I take full responsibility for. 100%, the late endorsements this cycle all come back on me because scheduling, delegating, all of it, it's my bad. But, you know, it's okay. There will be more cycles. There will be more elections. I will be here for them. I didn't realize how much I missed the sound of my voice. I missed this. I missed you guys. I missed talking. You know, I'm not going to make any promises. I need to stop making promises about when I'm going to come back, what I'm going to do next. I will say that I'm going to try to get some conversations recorded, you know, out of this runoff election. And I am going to be trying my best to get even better and give you more quality conversations. There was a point where I was thinking, oh, you know what, I might be able to start listening to the city council meetings at work again. That is still a possibility. It hasn't actually come to fruition yet, but it is now the closest to being a possibility as it has been in a good while. And so, you know, who knows, maybe after the primary cycle, as things kind of die down a little bit, I might transition back into a city council recap schedule. I miss being as plugged in and informed as I used to be. And there was a part of me that really, really wanted to get back onto the city council reporting, with the District 2 special election. It hasn't really happened. There's been a lot going on. There's currently a lot of debate. The conversation about the multi-purpose center, debate is being pushed back on that. There was, some fights about, redirect, you know, sending a letter to, having directing the mayor to send a letter out to some agencies about redirecting commercial traffic so that we don't have trucks, you know, sitting idling near schools and residential areas and just creating more, you know, pollution, you know, for in residential areas and kids in areas where kids are. There's been a lot. There's a lot constantly going on. And there just isn't enough honest, you know, not there's just not enough coverage, grassroots level coverage, you know, people staying engaged and informed. That's what the podcast was supposed to be. That's the need that I foresaw this podcast plugging into. And so that need has not gone away. And, you know, all that has happened is that the podcast has popped up and been around for a little bit. And people are like, oh, wow, hey, yeah, this is kind of cool. This works. I like this. And then I just haven't been able to keep up with it. And so it disappears. And so there's still so much work to do. But I'm here for it. And I feel good about it. And I hope you guys will stick around because I think you'll enjoy it too. Send me your feedback. Let me know what you want to hear. Emails, theelpasobeat@gmail.com. I am still on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads at The El Paso Beat. You know how to find me. I love your feedback. I love hearing from you. Send me your thoughts. Tell me what you thought about Bill. Tell me what you want me to cover. If there's a race in particular, or if you have questions or ideas, send them in. And yeah, And with that, I think I am gonna, let you go. This podcast was produced by Richard Henneta, features music by Enrique Ponce, and we'll see you on the next episode.